Welcome back. And we are at that hour now where we're going to begin our final panel of this two-day symposium. Symposium that, as you know, began yesterday at this time, exactly 24 hours ago, with President Skorton's address. And we come now to a session that where we want to really focus on, I guess you could say, the subtitle of our symposium. That is the the path ahead. At this point, I'm grateful that I'm just the chair of the panel because I'm a historian, and we are allergic to talking about the future and about making predictions. It doesn't keep historians from doing that from time to time, but the talent, as they say, my three panelists, co-panelists, will do the heavy lifting as we talk about the path ahead. If it's the case, as I think was suggested yesterday, implicit, I think, in the president's remarks, but I think it came through broadly, that Cornell has lost a certain stature in international studies over the past several decades for various reasons. What does it mean for us now? Does it mean that we should try to regain that stature? Does it mean that we should put the focus more on preventing further slippage? Those, I think, are important questions. Should we emphasize current strengths? That is to say, should we really not attempt to be comprehensive, but take those areas where we are already strong and bolster those, augment those, give those our priority? Or, in fact, should we be looking for new areas and new opportunities? I think that's an important question. I also hope we can talk a little bit about in this panel about what I think all of us, many of us, see as Cornell's singular strength in many areas of international studies, and in particular, something that certainly none of the Ivies, the other Ivies, can claim, which is extraordinary strengths in what we call the lower campus, combined with an extraordinary amount of important work that's being done by world-class scholars on what we call the upper campus. Here again, both the potential, but also to some extent what we have done has been extraordinary and can continue to be. A skeptic might wonder, however, how much we're actually utilizing that strength. If in fact this is what Cornell can bring to the table, it would be useful, I think, for us this afternoon to talk a little bit about that. Finally, I want to suggest that from a selfish perspective, that I hope we can connect this to the Einaudi Center. After all, the reason why we're here is to celebrate the 50th anniversary of the center. And I think that this symposium and this panel will help inform us who are in the center as we do our own strategic thinking and planning for the future. What should be the center's role going forward? I think that's something that would be really helpful for us to talk about. And as I said yesterday in my prepared remarks, I welcome either emails from people, or I would love to meet with anybody who has ideas, who has suggestions, who has complaints about Einaudi and what we can be doing. But I see this as a tremendous opportunity, the symposium as a whole and this panel, for thinking about the center. Finally, I just want to suggest once again that I think David Skorton's address yesterday, and more broadly his interest in this, is tremendously exciting. He has made clear that in his second term as president, one of the pillars, one of his four pillars, I think was the phrase, was in fact Cornell's international dimension. And I think he's very interested in this. I think, therefore, as the cliche goes, in the midst of crisis, there can be opportunity. I think we have tremendous assets on this campus, and that together we can chart a course forward. So with that, I want to turn things over to our distinguished panel. I'm delighted that they're with us today. Alice Pell, who will speak first, is, as you all know, a distinguished professor at the university and the Vice Provost for International Relations. Speaking second will be Nick van de Waal, former director of the Einaudi Center, now the chair of the government department. And speaking third will be Chris Barrett, who just blew in from out of town. We're delighted he's here. And Chris is a professor, and he's also the Associate Director for Economic Development Programs in the David R. Atkinson Center for Sustainable Future, of course, here at Cornell. Our speakers will go for about 10 to 12 minutes, and then we will open it up for discussion. Alice.
Okay, well, I'm delighted to be here again. You keep having to see me. But what I'd like to do, I think yesterday, David Skorton really issued us a kind of challenge, both in terms of undertaking a strategic plan, and don't all groan about the idea of another strategic plan. But the other thing that's happening that has been part of the discussion for the last few days is the huge number of faculty members that we are currently recruiting. And if we get where we want to go defined correctly, then we can go out and clearly hire the people who will help us to get there. And so that the two pieces give us a flexibility and an opportunity for change that we haven't had for quite a while. So I think we really are in a place where some new ideas, some new approaches are possibilities. On the other hand, and I guess it took me several years as Vice Provost to figure this out, I went to one of our Ivy Plus meetings, which is people like me and the diverse Ivy League institutions plus a couple of others. And everyone was whining and saying, my college is so decentralized. And the reason we have a decentralized university is so that faculty can actually have the room to take initiative. And what we need to do is to figure out how we come up with the proper balance so we can have coordinated programs without them being top down from day hall. I think that because we have the opportunity to hire really a lot of faculty in the next 5 to 10 years, and probably the most radical part of David Skorton's speech yesterday was his suggestion that as we're looking at individual positions within departments, that the international component be a consideration for the types of people we're looking for. That's actually a pretty unusual idea, and one that could have a profound impact on what we're going to be doing. But we need to have a good idea of where we want to go before we can take advantage of that. So I think that there are several areas. I'll pick on water, because we all need it, that if you look at the age of the people on this campus with real expertise in water, and Gil, I'm not trying to be rude to you, we have, I think Tomo and Mike Walter are in their late 60s, and everyone else is older than that, with one other exception, a couple of exceptions. We're in real danger of losing an area where we've had long-term expertise, and an area where if one's thinking strategically, we want to have expertise in the future because of the threats of climate change and water scarcity. But we need to talk to our colleagues in civil engineering or in biological and environmental engineering how much we need those people in order to go forward. And we need to figure out the mechanisms to make that happen. Again, we're going to have to figure out a mechanism to organize ourselves. How our international programs are arranged on campus is something that the more I look at it from my current perch, the stranger it is. There are some wonderful examples. I think of the conference that Abby Cohn and Susan McCooch and others organized on linguistics and rice genomics. I think about the recent conference on water. Really interesting, creative, scholarly meetings. But then we know, and I think Gil was correct, that there seems to be a big chasm somewhere near Malott Hall that people just can't go from one part of the campus to the other without fearing that they're going to fall into some moat that has all sorts of fierce dragons in it. And somehow we have to bridge those divides more effectively. Organizationally, I'm not sure, Fred, whether we want to expand the size of the umbrella of the Inouye Center, and that might mean that there are people who have muddy boots and things like that there. Do we want to have some kind of virtual network? Our master strategic plan talks a lot about One Cornell, but how do we want to achieve that in terms of our international programs? I guess personally, I see it from a very practical standpoint. Certainly people like Chris Barrett and I have people working in the field. They better understand local cultures and languages in order to function. I think that the reverse is also true. People who are trying to understand the art or the music of a country probably need to know a little bit about how people earn their livelihoods. And trying to figure out the types of programs like the Rice language program that allow us to bring together these groups of people so they know each other. My academic background is in food security. One of my solutions for this problem is a bunch of lunches. I know the Atkinson Center has done that a lot, bringing diverse groups from across the campus together for three or four luncheons, and groups form. What, half the people know each other, half the people don't know each other. Trying to bridge some of these pretty arbitrary divides that we're dealing with. And I think we do need to spend time in the planning process as we go forward, looking at ways to make that happen. I think that the Atkinson Center is a good example of how having a little bit of money to buy carrots to provide incentives can make a big difference in the efficiency of doing that. So I think we need to focus on the organization. We need to have a vision. Are we going to be a mini Kennedy school? Probably not, given our location and given our relative strengths. How do we align our Ivy League piece and our land grant piece? And how can we come up with a really interesting image that we present both to our students, to ourselves, and to the outside world? I think very often it's how we present ourselves to ourselves that may be the most important issue there. So we need to focus on our organization. Yesterday, David was very clear about changes he wanted in our international education programs. The goal of having 50% of our students participate in some sort of international education, I think he was pretty clear. He didn't define that very carefully. But that's going to mean that we have to do some real change. I think we need to spend time on what is a meaningful experience and what types of goals we have for our students, what types of goals our students have for themselves is extremely important. It may have not been as visible as it should have been, but recently, Ron Sieber and Laura Brown and others worked together. Richard Kiley, is he here? Richard Kiley is going to be the director of a new center that will be focused on service learning and public engagement. what we've been working towards, and we're not quite there, but I'm certain that there will be a very strong relationship between that center and the current Cornell Abroad. I think that this gives us an opportunity to create some of the opportunities that many people have talked to me about over the next few years. And this is, again, an opportunity for us to bridge the campus. There are a lot of areas that need to be worked out as we expand Cornell Abroad. We need to come up with a good financial model. We can't have need-blind admissions if we then deny some of our students access to our international programs. We need to make sure that we aren't having arbitrary boundaries between colleges and that the programs can reach across the university. The Arts College is doing some work on a Cornell in China program that I think may be a very good initial effort in this area that will include the other colleges as well. So I think that there's a lot of work that's going on in the undergraduate education domain, and I hope that we are able to do the work that we need to as we go forward. I think we need to be doing that at the graduate level as well. Chris and I have worked on a number of graduate training grants together over the years. How our students interact both with local communities, but also with their peers at other universities is an opportunity that we don't think very hard of for a lot of our graduate students. Some of that involves teamwork. Some of that involves the opportunity to really work effectively on programs from diverse perspectives. So I think we've got a lot of work ahead of us. We've got to figure out who we want to be when we grow up. And we keep saying, oh, well, we're 50. We ought to be grown up. We're not. We need to figure out how we want to organize ourselves, how we take advantage of our sort of local creativity, but also allow ourselves to reach out. And we need to think really hard about the kind of educational opportunities that we're providing our students. So thanks.
Thank you, Alice. Nick?
Great. Thank you very much. This has been, I think, a very interesting day and a half, and I guess my comments will be sort of a commentary on some of what's been said. I'm trying not to repeat too much of what's been said, which I really agree with. I want to thank Fred very much for organizing this. I, from personal experience, I suspect actually Fred didn't do very much, so I want to more than thank Fred. I want to thank the iNowDy staff, which is one of its great strengths. And from Nishi to Heike, Mark, Walt, Elizabeth, and Robin, they did probably most of the work. Unless the iNowDy's changed, the iNowDy Center has really changed since I left, which I suspect it hasn't. So thank you very much for a well-organized and always interesting panel. I want to do two things. I want to first, my sense of the division of labor was that the previous panel was supposed to talk about international studies in general, and we were supposed to talk about Cornell, but they ended up talking about a fair amount about Cornell, so I'll go back and forth and talk both about Cornell and about international studies in general. Let me start with two comments about things that I think we often say at Cornell about our strengths that I think we need to be more critical of. And then let me talk about what I think of as sort of three intellectual challenges for international studies at Cornell, but elsewhere in the coming years. So, we hear a lot about faculty leadership and how this is a faculty-led university. And on the whole, I agree. And I've worked both at institutions where basically the students were sovereign, and I've worked at institutions, at one institution in particular, where the administration was sovereign. And it's nice to be in a university where the faculty actually matter. Faculty, of course, moan and groan about how impotent they are vis-a-vis the administration. But this really is a university where faculty initiative carries a lot of weight. I do think, however, that we are coming to the, in international studies in particular, we're coming to the end of what are the possible returns from faculty leadership, which is often the other side of the coin of basically, I think, benign neglect from Day Hall. I think the creation of a vice provost position is something that we should all welcome. It happened in, I think, 2005, 10, 15, sometimes 20 years after most of our competitors, but it puts international studies in Day Hall, which was long overdue. I think that if you look at our peers, what is striking about Cornell is the programmatic and institutional stasis, that the structures, the programs that we have today, on the whole, and with one or two exceptions, none of which are in the liberal arts, are the institutions that we had in the 70s and early 80s. Some programs have changed names, but on the whole, the programmatic map has not changed in 30 years. And when you go to our competitors, some schools that are ranked and have way more money than us, but schools that in some cases have, you know, much smaller endowments than us. This is simply not the case. Major initiatives are happening in international studies in a way that's not true. At Cornell, you know, what determined the institutional landscape that we have today is essentially a Ford grant that came in 1964, Title VI monies, the random occasional gift that wasn't solicited but just kind of happened, and then projects mostly funded by the federal government on the upper campus. The Ford will no longer give money to institutions like Cornell. Title VI is melting slowly but surely. We continue to be reliant on it in the same way that, you know, the frog in the proverbial heating water doesn't realize that he's being cooked to death. I think the federal government's support for USAID and USDA is essentially, I think, is similarly a sort of inexorably declining source of revenues. The sort of model that international studies was built on at Cornell, I don't think is sustainable. And I think that the only way that we can move forward and compete with most of our peers is with leadership and resources from the fourth source of support, which is the alumni. And for that, there has to be a much more concerted campaign than has been the case. Let me say also that at Cornell, one of Cornell's distinctive issues is the small size of the liberal arts. Alice just painted the sort of positive spin on that, which is that we have a big land-grant component. But we should always be aware of the fact that the College of Arts and Sciences is simply not the same size as most of our peer institutions. In my own department, government, we're regularly competing against departments that have 50 to 100% more faculty lines than we have. And I think that has shaped international studies in fundamental ways at Cornell, which is increasingly, at least from my neck of the woods, increasingly an issue, even if it's true that we offer something distinctive that the other Ivies do not offer. Okay, second issue, we often pat ourselves on the back is how multidisciplinary we are and how several people have alluded to this. I'm not sure this is true at Cornell or elsewhere, and I'm not sure that in international studies we embrace multidisciplinarity nearly as much as we could and as I believe we should. But some of this is our intellectual obstacles. I think it's not just that some people are strangely uninterested in history or culture. In a way, that's a straw man. It's, I think, you know, the growing positivism in the social sciences, the postmodern turn in the humanities, and the specialization of everyone that makes intellectually multidisciplinarity increasingly difficult. And I think that's something that we have to address in international studies if we want international studies to remain vibrant. I think in addition to these intellectual obstacles, however, I think that it also has to do with the nature of Cornell as an institution. This is, in fact, an institution which is extremely fragmented. And, we salute exceptions to this rule, and Water is apparently one of these exceptions. But the divisions and parochialisms across colleges and departments is a distinctive Cornell problem, which I think we should address. We can all think of many examples of this. My own favorite is that for 40 years we've been bemoaning the fact that we have 7 econ departments. To a non-economist, the differences across the econ departments seem of a second order nature. But to the economists, they're huge. Chris could talk about this. And, we could talk about our 2 sociology departments that, despite repeated efforts, neither econ nor sociology has really been consolidated. These are issues that are very distinctive to Cornell and that I think we should address directly. What is the solution to this? I suspect it has to be more top-down leadership, more sort of cross-campus structures and institutions that facilitate real effective collaboration across colleges and departments. I think we too often pat ourselves on the back for the few exceptions to this parochialism that I think is one of the things that defines us. Having said this, let me just talk about sort of 3 issues for the future. I think Alice is right. Several other people have said this as well. This is an era of plasticity for the university because we're about to replace, I don't know the numbers, but it's something like a third of the faculty in the next 15 years. And so a lot of my questions, the next points I'm going to make are in the form of open questions, and I don't pretend to have an answer to them. The first, I think, is we have to find a way in international studies to keep the social sciences in area studies. I do think this is an issue. As I suggested in the earlier session, I see this a lot outside of the university. I think it's an issue here as well. I think we have to do, in part, I think the solution to this is for us to make to confront each other intellectually more than we do now. One of the interesting things about teaching our undergraduates, I teach a class on Africa where we talk politics of Africa, but we talk about the economic crisis in Africa. And I regularly get students that tell me, in the anthropology department, they heard the exact opposite of what I'm telling them. Or in the econ department, they don't talk at all about this stuff. They have, and some of this is, of course, just disciplinary boundaries. But a lot is because we agree to disagree about basic facts in the academy. As Adlai Stevenson famously said, you have the right to your own opinions, but you don't have the right to your own facts. And I think for people who value ideas, we are surprisingly timorous about these boundaries across disciplines, which own different facts. Secondly, international studies, we've talked a lot about how the Cold War shaped it, but arguably, we could even talk more about how a lot of international studies was fundamentally a colonial project. With the exception of European studies, of course. But we assumed, in many respects, that the genesis of our discipline and of our creating these institutions, we assumed that knowledge was a one-way street, that we had a package of technology that we were going to take to Asia and to Africa. We assumed that our institutions were far superior. So we didn't doubt that there were maybe great cultures in Asia or in Latin America, but we assumed that intellectually, they didn't have much to offer us, certainly not within our own disciplines. This may be unfair, but it's certainly true in my discipline, I would say. I think what is definitely true is that the capacity and the quality of institutions in the developing world has really improved. And we have to figure out new ways, I think, to consume the intellectual production that is now available in a way that was not available 20, 30 years ago in these countries. And I think this is, you know, our models of how we do this, of how we invite people from the third world to Cornell, or how we go to these countries to do technical assistance, really hasn't changed in about 30, 40 years. And I think that is something, again, I don't pretend to have answers, but I think that's something that we have to confront if we want to keep international studies relevant. Thirdly, and focusing specifically on my interest in international development, I really do think that the field of international development, as it's been constituted since World War II, is coming to an end. I mean, particularly with the emergence of capital flows and the emergence out of poverty of China and India, and you know, conjuncturally with the major economic crisis coming today, I think that the USAID and the USDA and the World Bank funds that we've come to rely on are going to decline very quickly. I think there are also more and more competitors who are much cheaper than us for the remaining funds. And as we engage in this and deal with, I think, what will be an inexorable decline, I think we have to confront the one area in international development where I think we have failed the most, and that is, capacity building and institutional development in the developing countries. I think that we could make a contribution in this area that generally we have failed to make. My favorite example of this is that Nigeria at independence had maybe 50 college graduates, and now has 75,000 college graduates. Yet most experts would agree that institutional capacity in Nigeria has declined over this time period. And it's, we have hundreds of people who work on capacity building projects in the developing world. But I dare say there's not more than a handful of those people who have thought about this paradox with any profundity. So I do think that if we want to remain relevant, we have to think more seriously about institution building and capacity development than we have thought, in a kind of model that has not changed in 40 years, where we send a short-term team out, we talk to the best and the brightest of whoever we meet locally, and then after a couple weeks, we come back to Cornell and say, we've engaged in capacity development. I really do think that if we want to remain relevant in the field of international development, we have to do that better than we have. And I'll stop there. Thank you.
Thank you, Nick. Chris?
Thank you very much, Fred. And thank you all for having me here. And my apologies for not having been present. I really feel like I missed out on something, but as Fred mentioned, I have just gotten back into town. I want to agree with much of what has just been said by both Alice and Nick. In reflecting on what I would say today, I had to ask myself the question, why did I come to Cornell 13 years ago? And the answer was pretty simple. There are two really distinguished sets of universities in my world, the Ivy League or Ivy League plus type universities that are the elite homes of the disciplines, and the land-grant universities that have established the standard for practical applied research that really transforms the societies in which they're embedded. And the intersection of those two sets has only one member, and that's Cornell. We're the only Ivy League land-grant there is, which endows us structurally with some really fundamental advantages. And as an economist, if I don't preach comparative advantage, my union card gets revoked. Before I leave the door, I'm sure David Lee will jump me, pull it out of my wallet, and I won't be able to go back in Warren Hall. So it's really important to pay attention to this source of structural comparative advantage that Cornell has. And I'm struck that a historian invited three people who all work on international development to sit on this panel of what is the way forward, what is the path ahead for Cornell International Studies. Didn't choose three Cold War scholars, didn't choose three people focused on European art, and those are all very important areas of study. But it, I think, signals perhaps subliminally, Fred, that international studies really has at its root at Cornell a primacy on thinking about the developing world and the central feature of the biophysical environment, in particular humankind's relationship with the biophysical environment through management of natural resources and through agricultural pursuits, that most of the world still engages in agriculture and or is centrally involved in managing one or another kind of natural resource, whether it's soil, water, wildlife, forests, something, and that this is where much of the future lies. The population growth and economic growth of the coming century is going to be almost entirely in what we today call the developing world, for right or for wrong. Bad label, but in those places that are commonly classified as low and middle income, that is where human population growth will happen. That is where economic growth will happen. That is also where an awful lot of outbreaks of terrible diseases will happen. That is where a disproportionate share of war and distressing implications of climate change will happen. Most of the century's coming big problems are in this area where Cornell has this structural comparative advantage of being Ivy League and land grant. So we need to take advantage of that. So Cornell was founded in 1865 on a very different model than any preceding university. The preceding universities were all intended to create a professional class. They were there to create lawyers and doctors and preachers and other leaders from the privileged classes. Cornell was founded to help transition a society emerging from a very turbulent period. It was intended to help cope with the technological change that was very rapid at that time, to help people grapple with the intersection between science and societal change. It was a different model, one that was open to everybody in a way its predecessors weren't. And it had to be inclusive to do that effectively. And I think that points, if we look back all the way to 1865 and we think about this deep structural comparative advantage, it points us towards what we need in a way forward. We need to be very clearly focused on the areas where Cornell can outcompete our better endowed peers. We need to remain faithful to the core principles on which the university was founded and which our distinguished predecessors built up a very enviable reputation. You know, celebrating multidiscipline pursuits in a really authentic way. And I completely agree with Nick. I think we pay much more lip service to it today at Cornell than is the reality at Cornell. We still do it relatively well, but we don't do it as well as many of those who came before us did. We've become increasingly focused on our own disciplines. We have to be strong in those disciplines to be effective as multidisciplinary teams. But, you know, to pick on the same example Alice chose, when I look at the people who were really setting the global standards on water research in developing country agriculture, these were first-rate scholars in each of their fields who really worked together to accomplish things. We need to get back to that tradition of finding multidisciplinary teams who think about systems-level problems. We also need to continue to emphasize, and I think there has been real benign neglect in this area at Cornell over my 13 years here, we need to continue to emphasize the need to be embedded in the context on which you're working. And this is why the Inaudi Center is so important, because it provides a portal and a platform for area studies, for cultural studies, for language study. Our students simply have to get to the places that they want to understand. You can't understand what's happening in Southeast Asia unless you spend some time in Southeast Asia, unless you can understand some of the languages, listen to the radio broadcasts, read the websites and the newspapers, unless you can sit and have a conversation over tea with somebody with whom you're visiting. We absolutely have to continue to push the capacity to do field-based muddy boots, as Alice likes to term it, work. And our students need that sort of training. I really think that's been an area of benign neglect, language capacity. I came here as a graduate student when I was studying at the University of Wisconsin, and I spent a summer doing intensive Swahili study at the Africana Center. We don't attract students the same way that we once did when I was a lot younger. We don't have that same capacity. We have some of the same excellence, but we've suffered some real atrophy in those skills, and we simply have to rebuild it to remain faithful to that tradition of emphasizing context, not abstraction. The other thing that I think Cornell has always had that is a little distinctive from many of our peers is an approach that I think of as fundamentally progressive in two senses of the term. The first is consistently favoring those who are traditionally marginalized. Cornell has always had a very strong emphasis on poverty reduction, on addressing structural inequality, on development problems at micro and macro scales both. But at the same time, that progressive instinct is towards improving the human condition for all. Progress, not just focusing on the bottom of the income or wealth or political power distributions. So these traditions and principles of contextualization, of a focus on problems and systems, and on a fundamentally progressive approach, again, I think help to inform where we need to invest, what we need to really push primarily. And that is focusing again on problems, and what are the pieces of the puzzle we need to address the problems that the world faces? How are we going to step up to the challenge of marshaling Cornell's considerable expertise, both on campus and in the legions of alumni who are around the world? How are we going to marshal that expertise to preempt water wars, to help conserve essential biodiversity and essential elements of cultural heritage in places where they're imperiled? How are we going to help those who are going to inevitably be climate refugees? Because climate change is happening, whether we like it or not. No matter how much we try to mitigate it, some of it is happening, and adaptation is going to be important. And that's going to involve wholesale movement of some peoples. How do we help transition those sorts of phenomena peacefully, productively, equitably? Cornell has the intellectual resources and the goodwill capital around the world and an extraordinary body of students, current and prospective, who we can deploy in this task. And that points to the last point that I would like to close with. I was down in Washington spending yesterday giving a series of presentations to government officials and NGO officials. And someone came up to me and remarked towards the end of the day, it must be rewarding to see the impact of your work. And I thought, well, it's sort of nice to see one or two really small things change, but the big impact that I have as a researcher, and I think this is true for the vast majority of us on faculty at Cornell, there are a few phenomenal exceptions to this rule, but the biggest impact most of us have are as parents and as teachers and advisors. Because we replicate ourselves multiple times over. I happen to have 5 children, so I'm doing it in spades. But you know, for most of us, the impact we can have is multiplied many-fold by the impact our students have and our children have. And Cornell, and this is another area of comparative advantage, Cornell is the biggest of the Ivies. We have more students here than Princeton has. We have more students here than Dartmouth has, et cetera. We can have a bigger footprint on the world by how we train and mobilize and motivate and encourage our students. And by really getting our students deeply embedded in these systems-oriented, problem-focused concerns around the world, students working in tandem with faculty as teams, we can change not just the Cornell faculty that's about to turn over dramatically, but the faculties the world over that are about to turn over dramatically through our graduate instruction. And as Nick says, an awful lot of international development is no longer going to be the domain of federally funded or World Bank funded projects at universities. It's led by private firms and by community institutions. And the leaders of those organizations are in our undergraduate ranks, or will be. And exposing them to the ideas and the opportunities from international studies is central to them being good global citizens, well-informed, able to really lead and change the world in the way that I think we all hope it will be. So as an economist, I've got to make a plea for comparative advantage. Our structural comparative advantage is the union of land grant and Ivy League, and the fact that we have more students than any of the other Ivies. We really need to be focused in everything going forward on exploiting that comparative advantage and putting it to good use to honor the traditions that are really Cornell's hallmark over the last 150 years. Thanks.
Thank you, Chris. I want to open it up. I want to use my chair's prerogative, however, to start us off. And I want to focus on something that I think came through in all 3 presentations. But I'll use Chris's words. And I want to focus in particular on the lip service that Chris referred to. and also on comparative advantage, because they might connect in a certain way. And here's my question for any one of you, or indeed for the room. How do we, and by the way, I should say that this is a question, or the subtext of this question grows out of my discussions with and the reflection pieces produced by previous directors. We asked them in advance of this symposium, as I think I mentioned yesterday, to produce short reflection pieces. And we got terrific responses. We also asked the holders of Einaudi Center chairs to produce reflection pieces. And what emerges from, I think, as a theme in those written statements is some version of this lip service problem, I guess. And so the question is, how do we reconcile here at Cornell going forward departmental interests, which are understandably driven by the logic of disciplinary development, and according to at least a few of the people I spoke to, and I don't think Peter Katzenstein will mind that I mention him, I think Peter views those disciplinary walls, those disciplinary developments being more important. And he spoke about a powerful parochialism that he worries is emerging. How do we reconcile those departmental interests, driven again by the logic of disciplinary development, with the larger interests of the Einaudi Center, of Cornell as a whole, to encourage, nurture, promote international studies of the type that Chris has eloquently laid out for us, but that all three of you have spoken about? Could one of you or a couple of you grapple with that for us?
Your job description, right?
I think that part of the answer to that is that we're all trying to get greater understanding of the world and the cultures and the people that we work with. Chris and I, several years ago, were working on a project in Kenya that involved looking at the relationship between poverty and the environment. And it turned out that our sort of field station was about an hour from the places where we were working, so we had lots of mobile meetings and really bad roads and lots of opportunity for discussion. Had those discussions not happened, we would have ended up with actually a very flawed understanding of the role of soil fertility in poverty. So I don't think that we can say that if we just stay in our little disciplinary silos, we're going to come up with appropriate answers. We would have come up with actually very incorrect answers, as had many of the people that we were working with. They were basically saying that the farmers were silly because they weren't investing in fertilizer. It turned out that the farmers were very smart because they weren't getting any economic benefit from the application of fertilizer. Mm-hmm. So I think we really need to figure out what's the question that we're asking, and are we going to be able to answer it if we stay in our silos?
Mm-hmm. I mean, I think that makes perfect sense to me, Alice. The worry would be that you are, in a sense, the exception. That at least because of, I think Nick referred to fragmentation, because of the way that Cornell functions, because of the college autonomy that we treasure, the departmental autonomy, that not enough of this kind of thing has been going on. I think Nick suggested a partial answer, which I think was, I think you referred to stronger cross-college structures, Nick, stronger non-departmental structures. I think that is, it leads to a question of how one would get there and what they would be. But
yeah, I mean, I think, if you want to get more cross-college, cross-departmental activities, it seems to me kind of obvious response is that you need more incentives to do these things, because I think faculty and students generally respond to incentives. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think Chris offered a partial response to the answer, which is sort of problem-solved research. You know, problem-solving research. You have a problem, water, and you a lot of different disciplines. Again, this is kind of a truism. We understand inherently that these problems are broad and complex, and so you know, the more pair of eyes that you get to look at the problem, the closer you are going to solve this. But Chris's university is one in which the humanities has such a secondary role. You know, I mean, you implied, and I'll confront you on this. You implied that you know your students can usefully, you know, go down the hill and learn languages. You know, but I mean that's such a secondary function for the humanities, and there's many of endeavors in what Val referred to earlier today as basic research, which is not problem solving, which is just a better understanding of the world that we live in. And I'm not sure what role that kind of scholarship plays in your sort of problem solving scholarship.
So as an undergraduate history major, I certainly have no objection to the humanities. Indeed, I think of the humanities as foundational, because if you go into, I emphasize the importance of embedding in context, and the root of understanding context is understanding the peoples who inhabit that place. I mean, that's understanding their literature, their music, understanding their languages, what have you. That's not something we do in CALS or the vet school or ILR. That's something done in the humanities departments of arts and sciences. Problem-solving research has to be based on strong disciplines. I mean, I really want to emphasize that. There is no good problem-solving research that is done by people who are not first-rate in their own area. The quality of the work done depends very much on the quality of the tools that go into it, and you need people who really understand people's relationship with, for example, I was having a conversation with a student earlier today who's worried about transformation of cropping systems in Asia. And he's trying to think about the intersection between plant breeding and anthropology and economics, because he sees all of them as playing a fundamental role, is how farmers behave, what farmers feel incentivized to do in terms of their practices. And I can't imagine how people would approach topics like that without having access to first-rate anthropologists, economists, and plant breeders. It's just foundational. The question is, these cross-college structures have to sit on top of strong disciplines. And let me hold out as an example with admitted bias. The Atkinson Center has for 4 years been running an experiment that I think is succeeding fabulously well and is perhaps not fully appreciated across campus because it's not relatively well known in large corners of campus. But the idea behind the Atkinson Center is that it is not a center that accretes to itself projects or staff or anything else. It's a portal. People interested in sustainability issues come into Cornell looking for a place, and the Atkinson Center provides them a portal to go find projects and individual faculty, et cetera. It's also a portfolio manager, people who want to invest in sustainability at Cornell but don't quite know what that means. Where do I put my money? Just like you and I give our money to a portfolio manager for our pensions, people give money to Cornell and then want someone to manage that money well to achieve some impact for students in research, et cetera. So we incentivize faculty-based teams working with students and staff and outside partners using those funds that come in. And the money goes to departments, it goes to centers, it goes to institutes. It's intended to seed new collaborations that are chosen based in part on the outstanding disciplinary qualifications of the participating faculty. And, you know, at the most crass level, it's turned $9 million of expenditures in 4 years into more than $90 million of new resources coming into Cornell. I mean, just measured in dollar terms, which is a big incentive for faculty. You get big money to go out and do your own thing. It seems to be working. I think we could do more of that. I think we could do more of that outside of the sustainability area. And Audi is a natural platform for some of those sorts of things, because Atkinson Center is fairly circumscribed. Sustainability is a vast area, but it's fairly circumscribed in the problems we can and should work on. There is a vast array of areas, studies-oriented as well as problem-oriented questions, that a place like an Audi is a natural home for a very similar sort of funding model to incentivize people to come out of their departmental silos and work together as teams and go out and do some really exciting things with students.
Thank you, Chris. Abby.
I would suggest a more specific notion of how we might incentivize what Nick was talking about, which I think is the prerequisite to do the kind of thing that Chris was just talking about, especially for those of us of the humanities or humanistic social sciences and arts and sciences, we have a really heavy teaching load. And all of us, no matter what our teaching loads are, just, it seems the shared universal experience is that we're all grossly overextended in various ways. And the resource that needs to be incentivized is time to facilitate collaboration. And I would suggest that we ask for two very specific pots of money to be allocated through the INAUDI, which privilege collaborative teaching across disciplines and colleges with an international component, and which also privilege not very specific thought out projects that can be funded, but seed projects where we get together and have these sorts of collaborations. And let me just cite two examples. So we've had this wonderful time thinking about rice and early domestication of rice and languages. But we've all done that on top of everything else we've been doing. And what got us through was how exciting the collaboration was. But none of us got any sort of compensation in terms of teaching or other sorts of credits for doing that. We taught last spring a collaborative, new collaborative course on Indonesia, which was highly successful. And yet we had to decide among ourselves who was it that was going to be the lead instructor to get credit for teaching that class?
Only one got credit?
Only one got credit. There's no model for saying that two or three of us should have gotten credit. And I think we need to start by thinking creatively about creating those spaces for those informal conversations, for the kind of conversation that Chris and Alice had in the Jeep going back and forth, so that we can then bridge to the more tangible projects that will emerge from that. And I think that's something that's in our reach if we put forward a model of what those kinds of seed building collaborative structures would be. We have the INAUDI seed grants, which are great, and we got support for this conference, but those grants are neutral to us doing those sorts of things as opposed to encouraging.
Yeah. That's very good. Tom and then Sarosh.
So I'm not a tenured faculty member here, so I'm uniquely incentivized to respond to incentives. let me tell you why I don't do more of what you guys described. And that is because my incentive is to get tenure by discipline. Right? And it's not to do exciting things that capitalize on Cornell's strengths. So I would like to do many of these things. Alice, you and I are working together on some of these things. I would get no tenure credit for that out at other departments, but that's the truth. If you want to hear what would make me do more of that, you need to incentivize me to make lumpy investments of my time in things that are not disciplinarily focused. And that's something that can't be done by asking the departments, because that's not what they do. It has to be done at the university level. I'm open to it, and it requires, though, much more than just getting people, I think, together to talk and to share ideas. It requires, career-minded young people to have.
If I could add a two-finger as the chair of Tom's department. It's not just the department that doesn't reward this, right? I mean, it's the political science discipline. And if Tom spent a lot of time doing this, he would have a harder time getting an outside offer so that we would actually give him a raise. It goes well beyond just, okay.
You have to combat that disciplinary departmental set of incentives. And so if you're going to be serious about that, that's what
you need. Let me push back on that just a little bit. Go talk to some of the assistant professors who've been funded through the Atkinson Center. And ask them if they think that they have suffered some sort of disciplinary regress. The ones who have been funded are largely leveraging their time. They're leveraging the expertise of their collaborators to tap intellectual arbitrage opportunities. So they're getting papers published in Science that wouldn't otherwise go into Science because Science isn't a journal that they would naturally target and couldn't possibly reach. Probably wouldn't carry a whole lot of weight with your Scrooge-like chair, but you know, in my world, a Science publication counts for a lot. Economists typically don't aspire to that. That's happened with a few assistant professors working in the Atkinson Center. The trick is how you do it, and I think Abby's really onto something. It's creating some small spaces where people can figure out, is there some like-minded person in a different area who knows a lot about something that I could leverage in my area, and likewise, she can benefit from interacting with me, and we both will be a lot better off. You only find that out if you have something that you're either having to get from point A to point B together, and that means a lot of time cramped up in a vehicle, or you're over topical lunches, or you're in a shared symposium or co-teaching a class, but we've got to create these relatively low investment opportunities for people to find out if there are these potential matches. And don't push people to do it. Only do it if they really see that there. But again, ask the assistant professors who've had Atkinson Center grants, and I think they'll tell you that their careers in their disciplines have been advanced, not retarded, by participating in those projects.
Tom, do you have a rejoinder?
So I am one of those assistant professors, and yes. But that's conditional on me having established my disciplinary bona fides.
Absolutely. But you should do that first.
Gil, was yours a two-finger, or are you just wanting to get on the list?
No, I think there are two things. One, with all the new faculty presumably coming on, the question is not influencing the selection committee to value international interest and so on. It's what happens afterward in terms of tenure, in terms of recognition. How does that factor in to the question of publication and so on? Publication is valued very highly. I don't have any sense that international interest gets factored in very highly into those kinds of decisions. So until they carry some weight, the new hires are going to get sucked into the discipline, the narrow part of the discipline. And I know in my own case, when I came back from 2 years in the Philippines under the Cornell program, the question came, could I carry out a program that we kind of started there, the water program, in a department that was engineering in a very technical sense. And I went to the dean of Cal's, Dean Kennedy, and said, where do you want me to go? If I go the international route, you've got to support me. I don't want to get any arguments from my department chair. And his question was, could I still carry out a domestic program? And I said, if you're talking about an individual student, an occasional student, graduate student, that's fine. I can do that. If you're talking about a domestic program, it's not possible to carry out both. So you've got to make a choice. And he thought about it a little bit and he said, okay, you go international. And I never had a problem with my department after that. So when we talk about leadership and increasing emphasis on the part of some administration, it can play an important role.
I think the other point about the whole tenure thing is there are a whole bunch of people in this audience who are full professors who have a lot of impact on what happens to people like Tom, and that we have a job to be outspoken when somebody comes up for tenure who has not just stayed in the dead center of his or her discipline, but's looking at some of those areas on the edges. And for those of us who care about this, we have a responsibility there.
So Roche has been patient.
So, to continue this discussion, I think there's one practical suggestion is is the ISS, Institute for Social Sciences model, which actually gives people in it significant time off. I think you've got a course off the first year, two courses off the second year, and a course off the third year, a private office, a different office, where you sit and talk with the other people in your ISS team. And I think that, you know, we've had, what, four or five rounds of ISS thematic things. I think that's worked, right? And you know, it's something concrete to ask for. It doesn't cost a hell of a lot of money. I mean, you know, when we're talking in fundraising in the billions, you know, what's this? It's fairly small. But something that we can
or science startups.
Right. Yeah. The second, I want to connect up, this idea that Nick talks about strong, a little bit stronger leadership with the area studies programs. You know, the location, I mean, the role of area studies programs in the university. So, people might not agree with me, but if you look at statistics, right, there's a statistics across the university is now one department, but lots of different departments use the statistics department. The people in statistics teach courses for people in ILR, they teach courses for people everywhere. So it's kind of, you know, although it's an independent department of its own, it's also a service department to the university, meeting university needs everywhere. I'm saying, why shouldn't the area studies programs be similar service departments as well? I mean, and why shouldn't the president sort of say, and top leadership say that, we want every graduate of Cornell, whether they are undergraduates or graduates, whether they're engineers or not, to have a global mindset, to be conversant with one area of the world, whichever they choose. Right? And so just make it a requirement. This is what strong leadership is about. And then, you know, this gives area studies programs and, you know, people at international the new relevance. I mean, and, you know, and more people getting interested in international studies.
I mean, I don't disagree. I mean, one of the striking things, I think if you look at, say, language acquisition. So I think everybody in the room agrees that it's useful to know something of the local language if you want to understand people's view of the world. But, you know, the reality is that our students speak less fluently languages than their parents or than the generation that was here in the 70s. The reality is that an engineer at Cornell 50 years ago almost certainly had Latin or Greek in high school, plus maybe French or German. This was part of what an educated person did. And the truth is that's just not the case anymore. It's just not the case that people outside of the humanities speak foreign languages. There's just less of an emphasis. The opportunity cost for our graduate students to spend 3 years learning a foreign language, or even to spend a summer learning Swahili, like Chris did, is too high. It's perceived as time that you're not doing learning useful things like high-tech statistics or a technical understanding of one of these public policy issues. And so, you know, the reality is that despite the fact that we agree so much on this, language acquisition is not what it was 30 years ago.
I'm not sure you're right about that, actually. My understanding is, and I stand to be corrected, but it's that at least in the recent past, I mean, you may be right over a longer period, Nick, but that the demand for languages is growing. And in fact, certainly I think there's a growing recognition on the part of undergraduates and prospective students. And I, admittedly, it's a small sample, but parents that I speak with, a self-selected group, obviously, but their emphasis on language acquisition seems stronger. So, I mean, it may be.
Well, I think what's happened, if I could interrupt, is there's been a broadening. So, you know, my parents' generation had the choice of basically, you know, Latin, Greek, and then three European languages. Now there are way more choices, and in that sense, demand has broadened. But I don't think, I mean, I believe it's a matter of fact that our entering freshmen have less language proficiency in one language than did kids who entered Cornell 30 years ago.
I wonder about that. Okay. A gentleman, so yes, you've been very patient. Yes.
John Bishop, ILR. I want to
go to a point that Chris made about our primary influence on the world to its benefit is through our students. And the United States represents 4% of the world's population. We're a world university. 7.5% of our undergraduates are from abroad. Maybe 30% or 40% of our PhD students are from abroad. But the master's program is maybe 20 or something like that. I think one way to internationalize the campus is to bring more students at the master's and the undergraduate level to campus and integrate them better. That means first select them so that they have reasonable English competence and that cheating that goes on in some parts of the world on TOEFL and so forth, that we fix that. And that's doable through an interview and so forth. And then involving them in living with families in the United States in preparation for starting classes, and integrating them both with other students so that we have a lot of Americans dormant with students from China and Korea, et cetera, rather than a Korean community always spending their time with each other, a Chinese community always spending time with each other. So the people are rubbing shoulders, because the purpose is not just to send some of our students abroad to have the experience of being abroad, which I think is a growing phenomenon. That's the way to learn the language, is to live in a family that doesn't speak your language for a summer, and you know the language by the end of the summer, at least a lot better than you did before. So both integrate, get our students more involved with the world, because they're going to go work for international organizations and international companies that will want to send them abroad, because they all have projects going on, and if they are to be able to participate in those activities, they need the understanding. And I'll tell you, it's very different. I have a friend whose son is now becoming the VP for HR in Asia for a large world bank in a large domestic company. I guess I shouldn't indicate the name. For Asia, based in Hong Kong, the culture of the business is entirely different there than in the United States, and yet he's running HR and worrying about the legal implications and so forth. So we, our people, our graduates, and he's a Cornell graduate, are experiencing this kind of thing. We ought to do a better job and give them more exposure to that kind of thing. So when they go off in their professional lives, I think we are not spending enough time on thinking about the interests and the needs of our students. We are talking more about our research. I think we should be thinking of having our students help us understand and do a better job of educating the 96% of the world's population that lives outside the United States.
Let's do this. I saw two or three hands. Maybe there are no longer two or three hands. I was going to say we can capture any remaining questions all together. And then if I could ask our panelists to try to keep them straight, then I'll have you answer. I also want to give you an opportunity for a final word, if any of you want to say something before we wrap up. One question here, I know. Were there other questions? Yes, one at the back. Okay, so let's have your two questions, and then we'll get responses.
I have a couple of suggestions for increasing our students' exposure to international development or studies. One is to use the Cornell Adult University model, not for the cost, but for the content of what they do abroad. They have these mini courses for alumni to take them all over the world, including the United States, to look at culture and what's working in other countries. And so, that might be a model to look at. for our students, a mini, sort of like a mini course or introduction. Because we all know that one thing that precludes a lot of our students from having an international experience, one is the time, and the other has to do with the cost. So that's one thing. The second thing would be to look at the culturally rich environment we have here in the United States. We're increasingly a multicultural society. And at the University of Delaware, they have a course that's something like, helping immigrant populations and their children outside of the Delaware region. So we might look at something like that as a first step for students to have an international experience, and that is working with either the immigrant population or the group, many groups of people that we have right here.
We do have, through Extension, a number of programs in upstate New York working with immigrant populations on nutrition. Pilar Parra is one of the people who runs that with Christine Stark and others in nutritional science. So those opportunities actually exist and often are looking for student interns.
Okay. Yes.
I believe most of you spoke about multidisciplinarity, my question kind of focuses on that, but a previous presenter spoke on the IGRT program that I believe on poverty reduction that you're involved in, Chris, and specifically I was wondering if you could answer kind of how that is trying to bridge the disciplines of the different campuses here on campus. What's been going well, what could be done better in the future? And then expanding on that to the entire panel, kind of the role and responsibility of individual professors in applying for outside grants such as these to fulfill the mission of multidisciplinarity in international studies and sustaining the vibrancy of international studies with endowments and internal funding driving that, and also providing opportunities for students to engage in multidisciplinarity work in an international.
You want to start, Chris?
Shall I jump in since there's a question specifically directed at me about IGRT? For those of you who aren't familiar, the National Science Foundation runs PhD training programs called Integrative Graduate Education and Research Traineeship Programs, IGRT, classic awkward acronym from the federal government. But the IGRT, there are about 120 IGRTs nationwide. The vast majority are based in the natural sciences and engineering. But there are a few that get into the social sciences. I'm not sure that there are any in the humanities. They'd be pretty exceptional. But the principle behind IGRT is to push students to get outside of their classical disciplinary training. And so they're typically consortia of faculty at one or sometimes a couple of universities who put together a cross-disciplinary curriculum for students. So Cornell actually has more IGRTs than any university in the country. So we fail at lots of things about multidisciplinarity. That's one where I think our system of graduate fields and our breadth requirement predispose us to be successful at this, and the evidence is we are. We have six, I think, current IGRTs at Cornell, where I only found one other university that had four. So we're doing okay in this area. But they're challenging, and not all of them are as broad as they might sound. I mean, sometimes it's seven different flavors of biological engineering. The food systems and poverty IGRT, to which you refer, Rebecca, is 23 different graduate fields at Cornell. It really is quite vast, which is a real challenge for those of us who try to manage this motley crew. But the distinctive thing about our IGRT compared to most is all students have international experience going to Ethiopia or Kenya for both a group project, so they have to do a essentially pro bono group consultancy for roughly 3 weeks for some outside body that needs a team of people with some expertise to look at an issue. So we had a group that was looking at climate change adaptation in teff breeding, for the Ethiopian Agricultural Research Institute last summer. Another group that was looking at climate change adaptation strategies for herders in dry lands in southern Ethiopia last summer. So you have these sorts of small group projects that push people into the field alongside one another with some tangible output they have to generate in a very short matter of time. They learn a lot about themselves, their discipline, how to work with each other. I think it's a terrific experience. I think if you ask the students, they'll tell you it's a terrific experience. Then it also equips them, it gives them a small research fund as well as a plane ticket for their advisor to go to the field for a semester and a summer and do intensive research for their own dissertation. So this is a model we had to take time to convince NSF to fund, frankly. It's a little bit outside their norm. It's hard to run, it's expensive to run, but it is exciting, and we're getting some fabulous students. And we are getting a number of students who came to Cornell expressly for that food systems and poverty reduction IGRT too. I really think that there is potential in this, and again, it plays to Cornell's comparative advantage. The trick is funding these things going forward. There are always two crucial elements in any university program: human resources, getting the time, as Abby's pointed out for us, and financial resources. And you can't do anything substantive without both of them. So the trick is carrying on funding models for those sorts of programs going forward. That's not easy. A much less ambitious approach to that is simply to get funds to, for example, provide faculty teams who are going to work in the field with funding to bring a student along, where you don't have to pay for your student. Rather, the student comes with their own funding if you're willing to embed him or her in your research project. That's the sort of thing alumni will love to give for. I mean, they want the next generation of students to have these sorts of experiences, to work side by side with a faculty member in rural Thailand or in the slums of Rio or something. I mean, this is an easily fundable project. We just have to get creative and figure out how to set up a structure to facilitate that so that students can do this, perhaps not on a cohort scale the way NSF funding lets us do it for a few years, but at least on a more micro scale across the campus.
Nick or Alice, anything to add to this, or do you want to otherwise segue to a final comment? But no, Alice.
I was just going to make the comment that I think one of the things that Anoudi has done an excellent job over the last few years, which have been challenging in terms of budgets, is to retain the travel grants and the seed grants as a priority, because that does help come up with that kind of not huge amounts of money, but money that really does make a difference.
I think Nick might agree with this, but certainly in my experience as director, and Nishi and Heike know this, nothing gives me more satisfaction than being part of that process, Alice, and being able to give out both the travel grants and the seed and small grants. Do you have a quick word, all three of you? Do you have anything you want to, any sort of profound remark that you want to, as we draw to a close?
No,
I just think that I like the word plasticity in terms of where we are in terms of international programs. And as we go forward, do come up with new ideas of how we can set ourselves up to take advantage of the opportunities. I think Chris has done a wonderful job of outlining.
I just want to make really one comment. Chris referred in passing really to the field system. And the field system has its critics in terms of training graduate students. It has its problems, but I want to speak up in favor of the field system. Almost all of my graduate students, and it has something to do with my field, which is U.S. foreign relations history, but almost all of them have had a person from another department, usually government, but they've had at least one person on their exam committee and on their dissertation committee who is from another department. So this is, you know, interdisciplinary education at work. I think they've benefited from that experience. And that's made, that's connected in a way. It's not having to do with the field structure per se, but it's something that we certainly encourage at Cornell, as you all know. The field system also works in the sense that it will bring in historians from other departments. They too can work with our grad students. And at my previous institution, UC Santa Barbara, I may have said this yesterday to somebody, I interacted with historians almost exclusively. And one of the great things about being at Cornell these 8 years is that I've formed attachments really across the campus. This happened before I became Ainati director. The Southeast Asia program was critical in this regard, the REPI Institute. I think this is something, and it really goes to much of what we've talked about today, and it goes to, again, this point about comparative advantage that I think is important. What I want to do as we finish is just issue a few words of thanks and then send us on our way. I want to thank our outside visitors. Steve has been with us from the start, Steve Hansen from start to finish. And it's been great, Steve, to have you with us. Craig Calhoun, Barbara Hill, Don Feiler, of course, were also here and made a tremendous contribution, and I'm grateful to them. I want to thank, in particular, the Ainati Center staff. Nishi is here. Our associate director, Elizabeth, who I think is probably not here. Let's clap anyway. Robin, who I think is also not here now that we've started. Nikki, I see at the far back. I want to thank. Walt, are you around, Walt? Somewhere? There he is. And then over here is Mark, who's taking copious notes as we speak. And finally, the person who I think more than anyone has been responsible for putting together the program, for getting everything in place in terms of just organizing this event. I want to thank Heike Mitchelson in particular. We certainly wouldn't be here and wouldn't have been able to do this, as the saying goes, without Heike's expertise and her tireless work on this, and I'm really grateful. Finally, we have our annual reception coming up at 5 o'clock in this very room. I hope you can wander off somewhere and come back. And then I suppose officially we can now say that the Ainati Center has begun its second half century. We can call this the beginning. I think we're off to a great start because of this symposium, because of the involvement of all of you. I've gotten excellent ideas. And again, I would love to hear from all of you more about this. And with that, ladies and gentlemen, we're adjourned. Thank you.